I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi folks, I'm Jack Kennedy and welcome to Farm Tech Talk, the livestock show. October has turned wet and windy and farmers are hearing about emission reductions, but also a raft of new schemes to be rolled out over the 2023 to 2027 period. Shout out to our supporters, Ornua, the European Milk Forum and Grassland Agro for helping us make this happen. Folks, a special show tonight and today. Last weekend, we heard for the first time, I suppose, about the emission reduction targets for agriculture. So we have a special show to engage stakeholders and discuss what impact these reductions might have on the industry. Shortly, I'll be joined by Chagas Director Frank O'Mara, ICBF's Andrew Cromie, IFA President Tim Cullinan, and ICMSA President Pat McCormack. But first, as normal, I have two quick fire questions each for Aidan Brennan and Darren Carty. Remember, email your questions to farmtechtalk@farmersjournal.ie or WhatsApp 086-836-6465. Darren, two quick questions to you on the schemes that came in. First question, asked Darren, what was he most impressed with and disappointed with on the news about the new farm schemes?
Yeah, Jack, sure. Look, I suppose the most impressive one had to be the new agri-environment scheme, or what's becoming the flagship of Pillar 2 payments. It has a fund of $1.5 billion, which is significant in the overall scheme of things. It's only closely, followed by ANC at $1.25 billion over the next RDP. And like, it does have the potential to put up to 10,000 farmers, 10,000 euros into farmers' pockets who would participate in the landscape feature of it, or for farmers that are, say, participating on an individual basis, up to 7,000. And look, I think, Jack, that is something that has been missing in this. Farmers have wanted, I suppose, maybe some certainty around the continuation of GLAS, and we've heard so much about a new WIPS type 4. So at least this now is 50,000 farmers with a payment of either up to 7,000 or 10,000. So it has to spell good news. Okay. I'd say close to home, Jack, on what's most disappointing. And look at the sheep welfare scheme, payment rate staying at 10 euros a year. And look, I suppose you could look at this two different ways, and it's good that the overall funding has been secured, but I think sheep farmers would have been hopeful of maybe an increase in the level of payment on that. So that for me is the most disappointing.
Okay, they saw you coming in there in your new Jeep and they said, they have enough. Second question, ask Darren, any idea what will be the qualifications for the new environmental scheme? So it relates obviously, Darren, to what you just talked about. Any idea what will be qualifications for the new environmental scheme?
Yeah, so we've a couple of, Jack, not a huge amount, but it's going to be rolled out. It's going to be sort of, well, two elements is probably the best way of describing it. There's going to be one which is called a landscape element, and that's going to follow the EIP model. And what it's going to be is farmers will have to cooperate in an area. So it'll be primarily targeted, I think, towards sort of upland or hill areas. So the likes of the Suez scheme in Wicklow, the Blackstairs Mountains, or the McGillicuddy Weeks sort of EIP initiatives, farmers will have come together sort of to participate. And that's the one that has a payment of up to 10,000 per farmer. The average payment that they're envisaging will be around 7,000 in that. And they're looking at 20,000 farmers being involved on that side, that element of it. The other element is, I suppose, on an individual basis, improving biodiversity or say meeting certain kind of measures. That's going to have 30,000 places, up to 7,000 of a maximum payment. And they're envisaging that the average payment will be around 5 million. As mentioned a couple of times, Jack, GREEP, multi-species. There's no reason what will be in it, but I think that you're probably going to see some of the measures that would be in REAP or would be, say, around a multi-species, maybe possibly coming somewhere into this, Jack, but that's as far as we know so far.
Okay, details scant, but we'll come back to it again, Darren, as you hear more. Thanks for that, and we'll chat again next week. Aidan, two quick ones for you in terms of quickfire feeding roll barley and milk yield has dropped. Should I change the type of feed I'm giving to the cows?
Jack, it's unlikely that, you know, that it's the roll barley is the cause of the milk dropping. Like when you're looking at feed, protein is important. Okay, and the protein is quite low in roll barley, you're talking 12-13%. But the energy is very high in it. Like, so it's one UFL as roll barley, which is a lot higher than the average, as you're getting the concentrate mixtures of, you know, 0.94, 0.95, which is kind of the typical. So in energy terms, which would be the main driver of milk yield, it's quite high. Look, there's lots of reasons why cows dropping milk yield now. You know, come to the end of lactation, grass is getting scarce, you know, just the weather has changed. So there's a lot of factors at play there. The one thing I would say though, Jack, is that, you know, how much is he actually feeding? How much is that farmer feeding? Because roll barley is a bulky feed. And if your feeder is set for nuts, which is very dense and heavy, you know, the 3 kilos may not be 3 kilos. The cows might be getting all that you think they're getting either. So just watch that.
Check that. Excellent. Second question for you, Aidan. I'm zero grazing in from an out farm, but the heifers are getting scarce in grass. And I was thinking of leaving heifers out and parking the zero grazing and open silage into the cows. Good option or bad option?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I suppose from a cost point of view, Jack, I mean, if you're zero grazing now and you're going to have to house heifers as a result of that, like, you know, you have the cost of zero grazing and you also have the cost of feeding silage at heifers. So, like, I'd say it's probably, it's kind of a, you know, you're robbing it from one hand and putting it into the other hand in one sense. Probably better, I'd say, to graze the heifers and feed silage to the cows than zero grazing, because you have one less tractor movement at play.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Aidan. No Adam this week as he's on the holidays. Right, folks. So as I said at the top of the show, this week has been a hugely significant week for agriculture, as it's the first time that emission reduction targets have been set for the industry. Essentially, the way I see it, this is a carbon quota for the industry, and the industry must reduce that quota by up to 30% over the next 10 years. To get a feel for what this means, I first talked to the director of Chagas, Frank O'Mara, on how he sees this impacting on farmers. We published online at the weekend that some of the emission targets or the reductions in emissions that agriculture is set to shoulder over the coming years. And there's talk of 21 to 30% reductions in emissions. I mean, Frank, in terms of farmers and I suppose how that sits with other sectors, is it a kind of if it turns out to be 21 to 30%, is that good or bad relative to other sectors in the economy?
Okay, Jack, and look, delighted to be with you and your listeners here this evening. So, look, it's a very good question. And to put it in context, the government in the Climate Action and Bill published in the summer set a target for agriculture or for the whole country to reduce emissions by 51% by 2030. That's a massive target. In other words, halving our greenhouse gas emissions. So the figures that came out at the weekend that you published at the weekend, which, you know, don't think they're fully signed off yet by government, so there's a certain element of speculation and so on about them. But those figures give for the different sectors of the economy what the emissions reduction will have to be. And as you say, the figures that were published for agriculture were a range of around 21 30%. And just to put that then in context, if you look at electricity, which is a very big sector of emissions in Ireland, it has to reduce its emissions by between 70 to 80%. And the other sectors, transport and home heating, they have to reduce emissions by between 45 and 55%, and industry by 40 to 50. So in comparison to all the other sectors, agriculture has a lower target. And the reason for that being that, you know, it's recognized that it's more challenging to reduce emissions in agriculture than in other sectors.
Okay, so, I mean, on the face of it, Frank, if you look at it in terms of raw numbers, it looks like a kind of a good deal relative to the other sectors, you know. But I suppose, what does it mean then, the 21 to 30%? What does it mean in terms of, I suppose, stock numbers or in terms of, you know, reference years? Or how does that kind of impact at farm level?
Yeah, so look, that reduction, 21 to 30%, that's going to require a lot of alteration in the way we do things on farms. It mightn't seem like a big reduction, but it actually does require a lot of change in the way things are done on farms. So, you know, the key things, I suppose, you know, the high level messages that we'd be giving out to farmers are still the same. You know, the first thing we want to do is, you know, have our farms operating as efficiently as possible, as little waste on inputs as possible. And, you know, so that's your fertilizer inputs, your feed inputs. And then that we run our systems, in particular our livestock systems, as efficiently as possible, so that, for instance, animals get to their target slaughter weight as early in their life as possible, and so on. So efficiency first. And then there's a range of technologies that we've been talking about for a while now, things like the protected urea, the low emission slurry spreading, clover, the protein level in diets, and so on. There's a range of technologies that contribute to reducing emissions that we would also be looking, I suppose, or encouraging farmers to adopt those. And between those efficiency and technologies, that's how, I suppose, agriculture can respond to this emissions target.
And but Frank, is there a piece there in terms of, you know, a reference year in terms of stock numbers? Because we all know stock numbers are important, we'll say, but they're not the be all and end all, you know. But I mean, yeah, is there a piece there? I mean, if the reference year is 2018, as kind of some are kind of speculating, like, I mean, will that actually mean a reduction? Like, and we hear some commentary kind of in the last couple of days around a stable herd, and that, you know, we need a stable herd to be able to influence change and bring about change. But I mean, if it is 2018, if we are talking about a stable herd, does that mean then that there will actually be there'll be a cap, there'll be a kind of a cut on numbers?
Look, I don't think there's a cut in numbers being contemplated. I suppose, you know, all our projections on greenhouse gas emissions in Chagas for the last couple of years, we've seen this herd basically staying relatively stable in overall numbers over the next decade. And indeed, that's what has happened since 2018. If you look at the figures, there's not much change, just over 7 million animals. And within our projections, you know, there's some small, I suppose, interchange between the various types of animals would be feasible within that. So look, I suppose that's the base level. And then on that size of a herd, we have got to implement efficiencies and technologies that are going to reduce the emissions of that herd by, you know, 21 to 30% over the coming decade. And if we don't do that, or if the herd grows more than what we're anticipating, well, that makes the challenge of reducing emissions even greater.
Okay, so is it easier then or better to talk about this piece in terms of total emissions? So if the herd is producing, or if agriculture is producing 23 million tons of carbon dioxide or whatever, and we need a 21 to 30% reduction, we're back to kind of getting down to the kind of 16, 18 million tons of carbon dioxide. Is that how we should be kind of framing the discussion for farmers to kind of understand it better in terms of the emissions piece rather than stock numbers, so that you can kind of allow for the efficiencies?
Absolutely. Look, that's what the target is. It's an emissions target to get down from 23, as you say, yeah, as our 2018 baseline, down to 20 to 16 to 18, assuming these are the confirmed numbers from government. And look, you know, we see that as a really challenging target now. You know, the efficiencies I talked about, the technologies, we still have to develop a lot more technologies to get us all the way down to into that landing zone of 16 to 18.
Okay.
A big challenge for the country.
I mean, and again, for the last couple of years, Chagas have been talking about the MAC curve and what it can deliver. So you're coming out hands up and saying the MAC curve can't deliver everything. But can you give us, so if you break down that kind of 5-6 million tons of carbon dioxide, what can you break down that into terms of, I suppose, what the MAC can deliver and what everything else can deliver?
Yeah, so the MAC, just for people that aren't familiar with it, that includes things like I mentioned earlier, you know, switching to protected urea, you know, additional clover, low emission slurry spreading, reducing the crude protein content of feed, and a range of other measures. And implementing all of those would get us about 2 million tons of that kind of, you know, 5 million tons, 5 to 7 million tons that we need. Okay. And so that's still a long way to go. And the big challenge is actually getting those implemented on farms. There is, however, a range of other technologies that we're researching, and ourselves and others are researching, and that are fairly near the end point of the research. And we'd be fairly confident that they will also bring about emissions reductions. And these are things like feed additives or again, some other fertilizer research that we have going on, or, you know, as I mentioned earlier, kind of getting animals to their target slaughter weight a bit earlier or a bit sooner. And so there's a number of technologies like that are kind of well developed and almost ready to be launched. And they'd probably get us another 1.5 million or so tons. Okay. So that still leaves us with a gap. And that's where there's a real big job for research over the next decade to develop another suite of technologies that will work and will be used on farms. And okay, it's not as if we're starting scratching our head with those. You know, there are things we can see, like, you know, we'll say, for instance, breeding animals that emit less methane is one avenue of investigation. Mm-hmm. These feed additives that we talk about, developing versions that can work at grass, is another avenue. So, but I wouldn't underestimate the challenge of bringing all those to fruition over the next decade.
Okay, and Frank, in terms of the likes, as you say, the protected urea and the slurry spreading, the lower emission slurry spreading, if farmers take them all on, right, and we kind of let's assume, as you said, it's a huge job of work to get farmers to take all that on, but let's assume they take it all on, and in 3 or 4 years' time, we're back to kind of a situation where we have reduced our carbon dioxide. Will that be reflected then in terms of our emissions? Like, will farmers get the benefit for kind of implementing the MAC? And is it part of the kind of the equation to get us from the 23 to 16 to 18?
Oh, very much so. And look, I think a really important point is that the things that farmers do, that they get counted in the figures. And that's what, you know, it's the EPA's job to compile that national inventory, as it's called, of how much emissions come from agriculture or transport and so on. And we'll be working very closely with them to ensure that any of the technologies that we develop that reduce emissions, that they are captured by the EPA then when they go to actually count the emissions. And most of them are, like, you know what I mean? One of the big ones is actually the amount of fertilizer that we use, the tons of nitrogen used in Ireland every year.
Yes.
So any bit of saving in that farmers and bring about through better efficiency in terms of how they use slurry, you know, that's immediately reflected in the inventory. So, and I think that's very important. You know, there's nothing more futile than doing something to reduce emissions if it doesn't actually get counted in the end of the day.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, the other one that farmers talk about is this whole place around kind of planting trees and, I suppose, land use change. And like, it's fair to say that land use change and forestry, it has a separate target for emissions reductions. I mean, Why is it separated from agriculture, I suppose, given that farmers kind of, I suppose, have a lot of forestry, have a lot of land use change, have a lot of, you know, they're playing with land, we'll say, in all their aspects of their farming. So why is that different, or what's the piece there?
Okay, so we'll say land use change and forestry. What does that actually mean? Well, obviously, forestry is simple. We know that people plant in forestry, it sequesters carbon. But also, if you change the land use, if you change from tillage to grassland, that has an implication on the amount of carbon in soils, or vice versa. So that's land use change that is counted. And the reason for keeping it separate, I guess, is, well, they are treated separately in this national inventory that the EPA compile. Obviously, they're very interlinked because, you know, agricultural emissions come from the land or from animals that are on the land, and so do these land use or land use change emissions. So look, we still don't know where the landing zone is for this land use change. It wasn't in the figures that were published at the weekend, Jack. And I suppose, look, one thing that a lot of people maybe mightn't be aware of is that while our forests and hedges and so on sequester carbon, Our bogs, both, you know, the Bordamona type bogs and drained peatlands that agriculture is carried out on, they emit quite a lot of emissions. And the emissions actually are more than the sequestration from the forest. So overall, there's kind of net emissions from that land use change in forestry of nearly 5 million tons of CO2. Okay. So that will have to be reduced as well under these targets.
But is it fair, am I adding two and two together to get five, Frank, but is it fair to say then that the land use change in forestry, that comes on top of agriculture, and in effect farmers have to shoulder, you know, the 5 million ton from agriculture plus the 5 million ton from the land use change piece?
Yeah, well, as I said, we don't know yet what the target will be in the land use change. But yes, look, it's actions that will have to be delivered by farmers. So, you know, in terms of the types of things that the government will want to encourage to see the emissions from land use change and forestry reduced, it's obviously forestry is a big, big part of that. And both planting additional forest and managing the current forest stock in a way to maximize its sequestration. And look, they are things that are going to have to be, you know, the roadblocks to afforestation are going to have to be sorted out, and the incentives that are there to encourage farmers to do that are going to need to be in place. So, look, I see it as a thing that is going to need to be addressed in both those avenues of the regulations and the incentives.
Okay. Two questions to finish up, Frank. One is, I suppose, the whole space of young farmers coming in terms of maybe what enterprise they want to get into or change into, whether it's into suckers or into sheep or into dairy. Do you see that kind of changing in the short term? Do you see them restricted in terms of what option they can go into in the short term?
Yeah. Well, look, that would be something we certainly wouldn't want to see. You know, we want, I suppose, if you want to call it the freedom to farm, you know, and that people can make choices to what enterprise they have on their farm. And I suppose, you know, in order to allow that freedom to continue, well, you know, we do have to get on top of these emissions as a sector. So, look, I don't think there's any proposals to look at that as a mitigation option. We're very much at this stage looking at what the technologies and efficiencies can do to deliver that reduction in greenhouse gases that's required, rather than looking at kind of the activity levels.
Okay, last question, and it's, I suppose, it's around Teagasc and the plan that they have and the developments that are ongoing, I suppose, to try and, you know, to try and meet these new efficiencies and to try and meet the new technologies. I mean, there's been a lot of talk of extra funding and at that piece required at Teagasc level. I mean, do Teagasc have a plan in terms of trying to deliver, I suppose, the efficiencies and to try to get farmers along this journey of trying to reduce these emissions?
Absolutely. Look, I suppose the first step of the plan is the things that we know about already to try to get those implemented as wide a base as possible. So we're working with farmers and lots of partners, including yourselves in the journal and the meat and dairy industry, through the Signpost Programme to work with farmers around the adoption of the measures that we already know about. That's absolutely the first hurdle. And that's going to be a major priority for our advisory service to work with farmers in that. But, you know, we do then need a very big research program. This is nearly like the COVID vaccine territory, you know, for agriculture. We've got to kind of get a big change in the range and the types of technologies that we have available for reducing emissions. And look, we have to set ourselves up as an industry for not just for the next decade, because, you know, the whole climate bill talks about getting to carbon neutrality by 2050. And we can talk another day about what that means, but you know, what we don't want to do is just barely get to 2030 and barely reach the targets, and exhausted we are then, haven't got that far, and when I say we, I mean the whole industry, to turn around and see that there's another big hurdle to jump. We need to get ourselves on a trajectory that's there for the long term.
Okay, so a very clear synopsis by Frank and a very clear vision for how reductions need to be achieved. Breeding is a key part of the MAC curve and indeed potential new technology. So next I talk to Andrew Crummie from ICBF on what he has on his wish list to reduce carbon emissions. Andrew, there's been a lot of talk in the last week, I suppose, about emissions, stock numbers, stable herds, national herds, reduction in national herds, etc., that kind of thing. You're looking at, I suppose, the stock numbers day in, day out as part of your role within ICBF, etc. I mean, In terms of stock numbers, stable herd, et cetera, can you give us a kind of a flavour of kind of what's happening or some of the changes that are happening there?
Yeah, well, certainly, Jack, over the last number of years, the herd has largely been stable. We've seen, you know, slight increases in the number of dairy cows, and at the same time, slight reductions in the number of suckler cows, which has largely resulted in us having a somewhat stable herd. However, I would say maybe over the last 6-12 months, some slight changes to that. Primarily, really, we've seen an increased reduction in the number of suckler cows over the last number of months. We believe it's linked to the finishing up of the BDGP there at the end of 2020, and also good beef prices. So suckler beef cow numbers have reduced a bit more in the last 6 months. But at the same time, dairy cow numbers have increased a small bit more over the last 6 months. So, but they have still largely balanced themselves out. I suppose the one other notable addition to that, what we have seen, Jack, is just a nice reduction, increase in the number of dairy heifers coming onto the farms this spring. Mm. And that has also been reflected in more dairy inseminations this spring as well. So as to the stable herd, it's certainly stable at the moment. Will it continue to be stable? I think we're dealing with two changing variables there, Jack, in terms of what's happening with the dairy herd and what's happening with the suckler herd.
And Andrew, what you talk about there in terms of the dairy heifers increasing, I mean, that's probably mirrored in terms of some of the processing survey work that's coming through that, their farmers are saying they want to produce more milk and they want to put, more heifers on the ground, more cows on the ground to produce this milk, So, I mean, there's nothing. And I suppose it's only 5 years since quotas were removed from the dairy side of things. So it's probably fair to expect that there is a pipeline of heifers and more stock coming in that dairy space. And I suppose it's trying to talk about what we're talking about here in terms of emissions reductions to align it to a kind of an increasing piece even if it's only in the pipeline for dairy farmers. Like, we need to tell farmers, I suppose, what's happening here, or what's the reality in terms of kind of where we're going on emissions.
Yeah. And I think, Jack, what's key in that as well is there's also a level of, we're really starting to see improvements in technical efficiency happening at farm level. So after the next burst of cows onto platforms and stuff like that, Phil has got themselves stabilized and done a bit of culling, and certainly the levels of technical efficiency are also improving. So EBA kicking in, age at first calf, and cows getting, more fertile, all of that sort of stuff. But there's also an important part in all of that technical efficiency discussion, Jack, is, and this is key in this, we believe it's key in this current discussion around the whole climate and environmental piece, is we cannot just get fixated in the numbers, the stock numbers piece. Otherwise, we lose the opportunity around the technical efficiency piece. And the technical efficiency piece, where we really need to move the discussion on to, is about understanding total emissions. And I was taken by the interview that Justin did there with Jason Clay from the World Wildlife Fund. I watched it. And again, he was very much promoting that we need to be thinking and talking about total emissions and what are we doing to reduce total emissions. That's what we've been charged with from an industry, is about getting our total emissions down by 21 to 30%. The simple and easy way to do it, everyone believes, is, we just cap. It's all about the numbers. And the numbers are part of that. But we miss the real opportunity around really driving technical efficiency and getting reductions in gross emissions if we just talk about the numbers. And certainly from our perspective, we'd much prefer now to see a conversation moving to talking about total emissions at a herd level and at an industry level.
And Andrew, it's fair to say, I mean, again, like that, we talked to Frank O'Mara, the director of Chagas, in terms of what the MAC curve can deliver and what new technologies are in the pipeline that they can deliver. And then I suppose there's another piece of a chunk of emissions in terms of, we're not sure yet what the kind of technology is that will deliver a saving. So there's a couple of elements at play. I mean, again, to kind of try and join the dots and link it up, I mean, he launched a carbon footprint, a revised carbon footprint with Bord Bia and Chagas last Friday. And I suppose, again, this is a kind of a new piece of work to kind of move the thing along in terms of getting farmers to understand this total emissions piece you talk about, rather than just cow numbers. Like, I mean, give us a flavour for that piece. Like, yeah.
So why that was a very important development, ourselves and Bord Bia and Chagas, for a number of reasons, Jack. It was to start to move the carbon footprint discussion away from being an outcome of the audit. Bord Bia and working with the dairy processors, have seen the opportunity. We need to get the carbon footprint the gross emissions data in front of farmers, not just linked to an audit. It needs to become part of the, for example, you know, the Co-op benchmark report that we send to farmers that goes out quarterly becomes an annual statement for farmers, and they're constantly looking at it. They need to be looking at this carbon data now in the exact same context, both their carbon footprint and their gross emissions. And they need to be thinking about, well, what are the actions and activities that I'm going to put in place in my farm that are going to bring down those gross emissions? And that's where certainly the development with ourselves and Boardbia and Chagas is very positive. One is that we're providing a supporting role there to Boardbia to do the calculations for Boardbia. It'll still be all Origin Green and going out through Boardbia. And the second big and significant aspect of that, Jack, is that it's based on now the very latest carbon footprint model, which Chagas just launched there at the open day there a number of weeks ago. So we've been able to bring all of those improvements that Chagas have built up over a number of years now into the new carbon footprint model, which is now available to all 17,000 dairy herds. I think it's going live on the 22nd of October. It'll be there for all farmers. And another important aspect of that, Jack, is we've now detached it away from being a part of the audit as such, that farmers can run an annual carbon footprint, and we're going to be talking to them with the dairy processors that it's just an action and an activity we'd encourage people to do in the month of January and February for the previous 12 months. And then okay. You can get an accurate assessment of where your emissions are at a herd level relative to others. And that becomes a much stronger piece of data on which to see the impact of what you did in the last 12 months and, well, what am I going to do in the next 12 months that's going to help to drive down this carbon, the gross emissions, the carbon footprint of the farm.
Okay. And I suppose one of the pieces around that, Andrew, is kind of, I suppose, verifying or validating, I suppose, the numbers that go into it. And whether it's that feed piece or that fertilizer piece and, you know, trying to kind of get farmers to input the right numbers, we'll say, what's really happening on farms so that change can happen or improvement can happen. Is that a part
yes,
of it?
And how can that play? That's certainly a key part of it. And again, you know, I come back to reference people back to the presentation just earlier, you know, and as Jason said, he says, you know, we want to have systems now that promote innovation that are not just reliant on regulation to sort this out. So promoting innovation in that context, Jack, has to be rewarding the farmers that are doing the right actions, the right activities that are going to drive down the emissions and the carbon footprint. And to do that, I mean, certainly from an ICBF standpoint, we are very clear in terms of the role of the EBA within that whole piece, you know, in terms of the potential. You know, we're very confident it can, you know, the MAC has identified and the further work that we have done in terms of initiatives such as DNA calf registration and greater focus on carbon traits. There's a million tons, Jack, there within the dairy industry, you know, within that whole, you know, now we're talking about a target of 5 million tons or 6 million tons that genetics can deliver from now to 2030. But there's an important point of that, Jack, which you've touched on, which is the auditing of that and driving it on. And that's where, you know, farmers being prepared to share their information, you know, in that sort of auditing piece, whether it's the genotyping of animals, for example, and sharing the EBA data and the fact that they're doing actions around high EBA, AI, SARS and all of that and dairy beef integration. And there's a second piece in there, which is a big part of the MAC as well. It's the feed and fertilizer. And it's the one part of the current carbon footprint that, you know, some people would, you know, raise their eyebrows in terms of perhaps the quality of the data. But it doesn't have to be like that, Jack. You know, I think we need action-based programs where dairy farmers can volunteer that information and you can support it with receipts coming from the compounders, the feed and fertilizer merchants. And then all of a sudden, now you have very accurate data that, you know, well, the farmer said he fed 100 ton of meal to the cows and 20 ton to young stock or whatever. And it's now been supported by the data coming from the co-op or from the private merchant or whatever. And that's the sort of new and innovative thinking that I genuinely, you know, I think we need now. And that can, in turn, I believe, you know, that'll result in the market-based incentives that ultimately, you know, will help to reward those farmers and will try and look to encourage them with, you know, if I'm getting an extra cent per litre here or 2 cents per litre, or maybe, and, you know, I think we have to think in the 5 to 10 year space here, Jack, as well, in terms of the opportunity around carbon farming in the future. You know, they may not have always be deriving their sole income from or their primary income from the milk check. There might be alternative sources in the future. But all of that's going to be very much driven off data and accurate data, validated data. And certainly that's where we see the opportunities arising more and more in the future.
Excellent. Andrew, in terms of breeding as a core role within ICBF, like, and in terms of new technologies that are coming, because, you know, it's fair to say breeding makes up a fair chunk of the MAC curve and a fair chunk of the new technologies that are potentially coming down the line that can potentially help this emissions piece for farmers. Like, what in your wish list, like, I mean, what investment would you like to see? And let your wish list be as big or as small as you like. Like, I mean, I'm giving you any amount of money to try and fix this, like, for farmers. Like, but what key and couple of investments do you see happening?
Are you offering some from the Agricultural Trust? Is that what you're suggesting as well?
We can underpin some of the investment, Andrew, if it's shown to deliver. Like,
but look, Jack, the big one for us, look, at the end of the day, is the genotype and the DNA CAV registration. The opportunity to be the first in the world, you know, with this new technology that has the potential to do so many things. You know, it has the potential to, first of all, really underpin where every dairy herd and beef herd is in the country in terms of its genetic merit. And your point is absolutely right. You know, it makes up 25% of what we're going to get in the future is going to come through genetics. So having the herd genotyped straight away puts you in a very, very accurate picture with regard to where that herd is at. And as that herd improves, you know its carbon footprint, you know its gross emissions are improving. So that's the first point from almost like a recording and an auditing point perspective. But then, of course, by genotyping the animal, we start to find these real outliers, which is what the breeding program wants, to really go after these animals that are, you know, good milk solids, good fertility, but low in carbon, low in methane. And that's the data we're starting to collect with at Tully and with Moore Park. Because, and they're the ones, look, at the end of the day, farmers may not necessarily like it, Jack, because once we get that data and we genotype lots of animals, there's going to be re-ranking in the EBA. But that's because we're going to be promoting new sires, you know, that are also given good on EBA and good on current milk solids and fertility. But now all of a sudden we can see, well, that sire wasn't really good. He was actually, you know, daughters were producing a lot of methane and it's these other sires. So that's the second bit. And then I suppose the third bit, Jack, and I'm focused here on the within the herd, is the integration around beef into the dairy herd. That's the key piece. And I know from a dairy farmer perspective, they look at the genotyping of their herd and they say, well, I'll do it for the heifers, but I'm not doing it for the bull calves or the beef calves or the dairy male calves. And yet it's those calves that the beef farmers are absolutely reliant on and want to know what they're getting. And if we're going to promote dairy beef integration, which is in everyone's interest, you know, we need suckler farmers with that sort of information that are then, they can make an accurate call with regard to the price, the value of that calf, because they have a knowledge of the genetic merit of those 20 or 30 calves from a beef standing. And they don't currently have that. And that's what causes so much ire and frustration amongst beef farmers. And certainly from our standpoint, that's the bit that really would help just to bring it all together. So this is one, Jack, that there are so many beneficiaries on, whether it's, you know, whether it's government farmers, dairy beef processors, you know, but what we do need then is the industry to come together and say, yeah, and look, and I haven't even touched on the market, the Bord Bia, the first in class world point of difference around all of that stuff. And we didn't even talk about theft and cattle and all of that disappears, you know.
Andrew, to pick you up on the two, genotyping in terms of, like, it's a big ask. Like, I mean, if you're talking about kind of, I don't know, numbers, it's 20 euros ahead, like, in terms of to get that piece of DNA kind of tested and to see what's coming down the line. Like, it's a big ask if you're doing that for all numbers. Like, I mean, but But I suppose you were saying that you have to start sometime and try and be ahead of the curve to an extent.
Yeah, and we also have to be smart here. We can break it out, Jack, in terms of the cost. Already, look, there's DNA tags. We have farmers involved in DNA calf registration. There's a DNA tag that will increasingly come forward in the future. So now all of a sudden, the farmer has contributed 3 or 4 euros in the collection of the DNA at source. So now we have that off the farm. And then now there's a bit of cost associated with the chip. And there's a bit of cost associated with, you know, at the lab and getting a genotype. And then there's a bit of cost associated with getting that into a genomic evaluation and getting a passport out to the farmer and getting a genetic merit. Mm. But, you know, by breaking it up in chunks there, I mean, you could argue, look, there's four partners in that mix. There's the farmer, there's the government, there's the dairy and the meat processor. And surely if we couldn't find a way to sit it down together, and, you know, we'll work out what's the annual cost of this and what's the annual benefit. You know, the cost benefit, you know, we've looked at it certainly, you know, across the industry. There's an easy 3 to 4 to 1 return on investment. And that's at that 20 euro cost, Jack. The other thing we do know is if we can do this, we can start to, we can continue to get that cost down, you know, in the future. Like it'll never be 5 euros, but there's certainly opportunities, Jack, to get it to the sort of more, you know, in that more in that 10 to 15 euro bracket in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. But I hear you.
And Andrew, I mean, is it fair to say, like, we've been talking about genotype in a while now, and it's there and it's become established, and it's a key technology, and we're seeing a gap in terms of the emissions reduction technology that we need. But surely something like that is a kind of, I call it a half-proven technology that can deliver some of that kind of emission. Once we start to use the information, there's one job doing the genotype, and there's a second piece, I suppose, a bit like microcarbon, you have to use the information that you get back to try and pick out your low methane or high methane producers, et cetera, and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And look, again, you're right. It's a technology. It's well established at this stage. You know, our systems through the Beef Data and Genomics Program, we're ahead of the curve currently in Ireland in terms of, you know, the application of the technology globally. You know, for us, what we want to do is we want to stay ahead. We want to be, you know, and we want to push on now and be the first country that has the opportunity to do this and to reap the potential benefits. I've talked about it in the context of the methane one. That's the current focus here around, you know, our particular discussion. There's another one, Jack, around the whole area of the carcass, the beef traits. Age at slaughter is a big area of interest. Again, the meat processors want to have confirmation and confidence that if they're buying through, pulling through this animal, that yes, absolutely, the greenhouse gas credentials are lower, and there's a younger age at slaughter as a consequence. Mm. So these are the win-wins. I suppose, Jack, it's like anything. In many ways, it's taken a crisis like what we currently have and will have for the next number of weeks to force people to now sit down and talk about, well, where are the projects or where are the opportunities that we have good alignment on, we all agree on, and let's find a way to fund that. You know, and genotyping is one of those. There are others. There are absolutely others. But I suppose from an ICBF standpoint, you know, if we were to put our hands up and say, look, the one game changer that we see that has so many potential benefits is the genotype one. Mm. And that's the one that we're going to be carrying forward into the discussions going.
Excellent. To pick you up on the other point that you mentioned, the dairy beef integration, like, I mean, you mentioned kind of beef farmers and suckler farmers, and that's all very well and fine, but there's a lot of dairy farmers that keep bull calves and male calves as well on farms. I mean, I think over 50% of dairy farmers, so like there's 9 or 10,000 dairy farmers that keep male or bull calves, we'll say, to finish, or females, etc., to finish on their farms. I mean, the efficiency gains that can be gained by selecting the right animals, you know, at the breeding, when they're breeding, it's for both sectors. It's right across the sector. It's not just one or the other.
No, I completely agree with that, Jack. And again, that just comes back to the, you know, let's not lose sight. I think we've got caught up in this, in trying to have this genotype and discussion. Dairy farmers have been very quick to say, no, we won't pay for the male calf, you know. Mm. And maybe that has slowed that conversation down. But I think we need to change that again now. We need to rethink that because there are so many potential benefits to this, you know, from a broad industry standpoint. And look, by acknowledging that, we can share the costs and we can all get the benefits.
And your point, your end point being that, listen, the farmer isn't buying a pig in a poke, whether that's a dairy farmer or a suckler farmer that wants to finish beef, that he's buying something that he knows can deliver X, X and X, and he's not being let down by you know, an imperfect good or something that's not up to scratch. Like,
which has caused a lot of the frustration in the dairy beef integration. So it's about addressing that fundamentally.
Okay, good from Andrew in terms of what he has on his wish list. Next, I suppose we can talk about new technologies till the cows come home, but if farmers don't engage, it's a complete waste of time. To get a feel for what the leaders of the farm organisations think, I talked firstly to Tim Cullinan, IFA president. Tim, over the last weekend, I suppose we learned that the intention is to reduce the agriculture emissions by 21 to 30%. I mean, that's the piece specified for agriculture. And I suppose since that, then there has been some talk that this is a big win for farmers. I mean, do you see it as a big win if those numbers materialize?
Look, Jack, I'd have to say, you know, none of this is a win for farming, but I suppose, you know, we have to put it in context as well. You know, if we're getting a ceiling, or it is a ceiling now, not a target, of 21 to 30%, obviously looking at other sectors, you know, it is, I suppose it's somewhat better than, you know, what could have been expected. But look, this is going to be extremely challenging for farmers. Obviously, there's going to be a cost associated with this as well. So from that point of view, you know, it's not a big win. It's another challenge, and a challenge that we have in our sector going forward.
Yeah, and a huge challenge, I'll say, Tim, for some sectors, we'll say. I mean, a lot of this is based, as you say, at the fact that a kind of a stable herd and full implementation of the kind of MAC curve and new technologies that are coming on play. Like, I mean, like, how might some of that kind of play out at farm level, like we'll say? I mean, are we looking at kind of quotas or limits at farm level for stock to play into this 21-30% reduction?
Yeah, I suppose where we're looking at, and you're right, Jack, I think it's important to emphasise here as well, you know, that farmers have been doing quite a lot already, you know, in particular working towards the MAC curve, you know, that Chagas have been developing for quite a while now, and there's a lot of heavy lifting done there already, but there's a lot of work would have to be done. You know, we are depending on the science evolving here, which is very important. And, you know, we see the work that is being done in Moor Park at the moment. When I speak about science, you know, the trials that have been done on different animals now that would produce maybe up to 30% less methane. And, you know, all of this will be going on the scoreboard to reduce the emissions coming from bovines. And, you know, we see what's happening, you know, with feed additives and all of the work that has been done there as well. And, you know, we are banking on that into the future.
You are. And I mean, Tim, correct me if I'm wrong, but is it fair to say that if those technologies are not delivered, well, then, you know, you could be looking at a kind of a stock number reduction, or you could be looking at a more severe impact, we'll say, down the line?
No, look, I think, again, we need to look at this, Jack. And, you know, we've seen, you know, if we look ahead over the past 20 years, so we're operating now on the same number of animals as we had in 1999. And I think it's very important to keep that in the debate as well. And, you know, for now, so we have to continue with that number of stock or animals in the country. But in the future, you know, we all have to look forward, and, you know, we would all hope that, you know, the advances will come in technology, will come in the sciences, and, you know, there will be products or vaccines developed that will reduce the methane further from our cows. You know,
From our livestock. Yeah.
And I suppose the other point is very important here as well. So, you know, in particular in the dairy sector, we've seen the gains from productivity over the last number of years. Like, productivity in the last 20 years has increased by 20%. No, that's, or sorry, 40%. And that's a massive achievement. I think going forward, we have to look at that as well. So getting more productivity and added value, I think it's very important here as well. It's something I've been saying for quite a while. So there's work to be done here by our cooperatives and everybody involved in the industry to get more value from the products that we are producing. Let it be on the dairy side, but also on the beef side. I think there's an onus now on the beef processing industry to add more value to the products that are the animals that are going into their plants as well.
I mean, you mentioned the dairy herd, Tim, and it's only, you know, we're little over 5 years since the kind of quota breaks were taken off, and essentially now we're looking at a quota break back on again. I mean, it didn't get much chance. The dairy industry didn't get much chance to reach its potential. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, look, obviously a lot has happened, you're right, since the abolition of quotas. Like, it's been excellent to see, you know, the expansion and the performance of that, of the dairy sector have done very well. And I suppose, look, we have to look at it as well, though. And, you know, we've seen earlier this year that our co-ops were coming under processing capacity pressure as well. And, you know, look at it from that point of view. Look, maybe it is a time now that we would have a reflection on where we're at. But no, it's very important in all of this, and that we maintain the animals we have at the moment, as I say, for now. But look into the future. We want to see that, you know, maybe we can have managed growth in the future. You know, but obviously, a lot of work has to be done here in the science, you know, on the grasses, different types of grasses. And you know, we have to be positive here as well.
Yeah. And so that comes down then to a cost piece, Tim, and at both farm level and at the kind of science level, we'll say to ensure that that technology happens, to ensure that that new technology comes on board in terms of the feed additives and the breeding side of things. I mean, we really need a big commitment, we'll say, in terms of trying to manage that cost piece.
We do. We need a commitment from our government. And, you know, I've been saying for quite a while now that for all of this to come together, there needs to be an absolute collaboration in all of the industry and with our government. And, you know, it's about sitting down around the table with our government, with the industry, and coming up with a plan to drive this forward, because there's going to be funding needed here as well. And, you know, Jaggers, they have a substantial budget themselves, but I think they need to relook at their budget and ensure that there's an adequate amount of that budget put forward, you know, for developing, you know, or continuing with the science in what they're doing into the future to ensure, you know, that we can maintain our sector. And, you know, we need, again, you know, we need to look at rural Ireland here and our agri sector, you know, what it does in the rural communities, you know, the amount of jobs that's coming from it, you know, farmers are making their own livelihood from the sector. But, you know, the entire industry is a massive important sector to our country, and the exports as well. You know, we're exporting almost 14 billion a year from our sector, and that's all very important. And if we go back to the Paris Agreement, and it clearly states in that agreement that in dealing with climate change, that it does not impact on food production, and, you know, food security has always been part of this. And I think it's important that the powers that be acknowledge and remember that as well.
Last one point, Tim, and I know you're under pressure, so I won't keep you any longer, but I put it to Frank O'Mara, the director of Chagas, that the land use and land use change and forestry, that there's a lot of farmers effectively in that bracket as well, in that sector, you know, the land that they're farming, and that's a separate kind of emission reduction on top of, I call it the core agriculture emission reduction. Like, I mean, is it fair to say that, you know, that the 21 to 30% is only part of the chunk of emissions that farming can deliver?
Yeah, it is. And I suppose, look, I think it's a good thing that the land use now has been separated out from agriculture for the moment. But I mean, I think the government needs to realise as well, and something I've been highlighting for a long time, is the inefficiencies in the forestry sector. So we're coming to a point now where a lot of the forests are coming to the end of their growing period and could become emitters, and you know, this is concerning. So we need a proper plan and a proper program around forestry, because there's a 4 million tons there that have to be made up as well. And the only way that can happen, obviously, if we have a proper planting program. And I think it's absolutely critical and essential that the government will look at this and try and get the blockages out of the system that have been there now for a number of years.
Okay, so clearly Tim feels we are in a stable herd position and we need to get new technologies up and going to further increase that herd. Next up, I talked to Pat McCormack, dairy farmer and president of the ICMSA, for his view on the reductions. Pat, good to have you on the show. A first quick one, I suppose, to start off with. I mean, last weekend we learned, I suppose, that agriculture has to shoulder the 21 to 30% reduction in emissions, you know, as part of its commitment to kind of, I suppose, nationally in terms of reducing emissions. But I mean, reading between the lines from what ICMSA have, I suppose, released since that, that I get the feeling that you're not as convinced that this is a win, because some other sectors of the economy are saying this is a win for agriculture because it's only 21 to 30%.
No, it's not a win. It's a huge challenge for agriculture. And given the commitment that agriculture has given or the contribution it makes to rural economies, it's a massive ask for our rural economies. You know, and we must also remember that we're only 5 years since the abolition of quotas. So we haven't yet fulfilled our dairy ambition and indeed our agricultural ambition. If you go around and meet young farmers, they are very, very keen to make progress. Meet farmers of our own generation, Jack, who were chastised with the quota regime for 30 years. They find it hugely frustrating that 5 years out, there's the potential for a pause in the growth of the dairy industry, yeah, and agricultural output.
Yeah, and I mean, you see that as a pause, Pat. Like, you see it as a full stop. Like, you know, but you don't want that. You want a little bit of growth, and you want the kind of flexibility of whatever technology changes come on board to be recognised when they come on board and move with it then as it happens.
To be fair, Jack, we've probably been, and I don't mean to be critical of ourselves as an industry, we've probably been a bit lackadaisical in our approach to the environmental aspirations. You know, crude protein and the percentage there can have a significant impact. The earlier age of slaughter of livestock can have a significant impact, as can protected urea and low emission story spreading. And I mean, we need to see all of these and indeed an improvement in the genetics of our herds right across, whether it's dairy or suckler, you know, deliver. And you know, they can deliver from a climate impact point of view and in a positive light. You know, who would have thought 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago that we would have achieved what we have achieved? And, you know, science is progressing all the time. And one thing about, in particular, the dairy farmer that we represent, they're willing to embrace new technologies. We see the, in particular, I suppose, the use of clover and low emission slurry spreading has maybe been an opportunity to significantly reduce emissions without reducing output and without reducing numbers.
Yeah. I mean, Pat, I take it from what you're saying that you're confident that farmers can deliver in terms of kind of some of the Chagas MAC curve savings, like that they can deliver. You talk about the clover, the low emission slurry spreading, etc. But there's obviously a big cost to implement these changes, you know, whether it's bigger tractors, whether it's the slurry tanks, whether it's the, you know, investing in clover and other technologies, etc. And that kind of thing. That could mean there's a big cost on farmers as well as being the technology of being able to do it.
A huge cost. And I suppose that's where Budget Day was so disappointing for agriculture. We want the flexibility in the capital allowances that farmers could write off over a shorter or longer period of time for slurry storage and indeed for low emission slurry spreading equipment. Because you mentioned it, yeah, very, very expensive gear and a 12-month waiting list. And I suppose, you know, buildings are at an all-time high. The price of them and the availability of builders is extremely sparse out there on the ground. And, you know, we would feel that more should be done by the government. They're very good to lay down the red print as regards where we need to go from an environmental impact point of view, but very, very slow to come with black ink on budget day.
And Pat, like, last question, and I'll leave you alone after this. In terms of, you know, the MAC curve can deliver a chunk of the emission savings, and maybe the new technologies that are coming, Frank O'Mara says and Chagas say that they can deliver another chunk of emission savings. But there's probably still a gap between what the MAC curve and the new technologies that are in the pipeline, what they can deliver, and I suppose what the emission savings that the government are looking for now, that kind of 5, 6, 7 million tons. Like, there's probably still a gap there. How is that going to be bridged? Can you see happening?
Well, you know, it's going to be a challenge. We can't underestimate the challenge, but I think, you know, if people embrace the technologies that are out there, we can go a long way. We also have to remember, you know, that we are a food island, and as a generation of people, it's absolutely critical. And I say as a generation of people that we remember we're the most efficient in the globe from a dairy production perspective, from an environmental impact point of view. Global population is growing. And as a generation, if we want to leave it, whether we're in Ireland or Europe or indeed further afield, if we want to leave the climate in the best possible hands as we move forward and also want to feed the population, we need to maximise food production of dairy and beef in this country.
Very, very last question, Pat. And I promise I'll leave you after this one. If you were to ask a wish list in terms of where the investment might go, you know, is there some piece of technology or is there some big investment that you think farmers could really benefit from on the breeding side or on the other side? Is there some piece that you'd really like to see happen and you'd lead, the government would need to kind of lead on this in terms of pushing this out as a lead piece of investment?
It's very hard to say one particular piece, Jack. Slurry storage is a critical issue for farmers, that they get the best value out of the organic nitrogen that's produced on farm. Equally, take, for example, sex semen, a laboratory for that can deliver from a dairy perspective, but equally can deliver maybe fourfold from a beef perspective moving forward, where we have an animal that's fit for purpose in the beef industry.
Okay, so clearly Pat feels farmers will play their part with new technologies. Next up, we've talked about breeding. The other big part of, I suppose, any future technologies that might play a big part in this space is fertilizer technologies. So I had a chat with John O'Loughlin from Grassland Agro about what's in the pipeline. In terms, John, of, I suppose, all that's happening, all we've been talking about in terms of fertilizer reductions and the swing to organics, this week we have, I suppose, climate emissions, and I suppose we really have a kind of a line in the sand or a kind of an indication that, listen, the agriculture part of this is going to be between 21 and 30% reduction in emissions based on a reference year, might be 2018. Nothing confirmed yet. Cabinet haven't signed off on it. But in terms, John, of, I suppose, how the fertilizer or the input kind of, industry reacts to something like that. Like, I mean, what's the kind of, off the top of your head, what's the kind of the kind of, I suppose, the first thing that comes into your mind?
Yeah, Jack, I suppose it's a new dawn, I suppose, really, in respect to agribusinesses. And from my experience and speaking about ourselves, I suppose we were trying to be really proactive in this space to help guide farmers with products and solutions through the change in maybe the mindset around, in our side of the house, fertilizer or even we've done it with dairy hygiene, with the chlorine and all this sort of stuff, that we have to make sure that we are prepared with products and services to provide that. All the agribusiness that we work with, co-ops and merchants as well, are the same, because I think there's a realization, Jack, that if we can't meet our targets, and whether it's water quality and we lose the derogation, that's going to have a really significant impact on all agribusinesses and farms as well. You know, so it's a huge challenge. It's, some people don't like change, Jack. It's kind of like the hurling, you know, you go to a club match and there's a lot of sharp puck outs and you have maybe an older sock in the stand roaring, driving in with you. Change is necessary, unfortunately. And I suppose what we're doing, we're launching a side health project. We talked about it briefly. We'll be recruiting for 2 PhD students. So anyone maybe coming out of college or that's around there, have a look at that and keep an eye out for it. But the key thing to that is to make sure that we can have take a more holistic approach to side health, to better understand across the three pillars of side health and to help farmers to meet those challenges.
And John, it's interesting that you say it, like change is, some people don't like it or whatever, but basically the change you're talking about is taking it back to basics, like where we probably were 40, 50, 60 years ago, you know, in terms of getting the pH right, in terms of getting the P's and K's right, in terms of getting, you know, that whole soil health fertility piece right. That's like, that's change, but it's stepping back to get things right, like.
It definitely is, Jack, like, and even clover, like, you know, clover is suddenly a new technology.
Yeah,
you know, you probably have maybe a bit more experience than I, or around longer maybe.
One second, John. Now, just to be clear, like, clover when it came out first was like, that was back when Moorpark started. I'll say 1958, 1960, in that early time. Clover was the key. I suppose, you know, and grass were going to make, I suppose, up what was going to be, but then milk price went up and then farmers had more money and they had the money to buy nitrogen, and that gave a huge return, like we'll say, and hence they went on that train rather than the clover train. It's amazing. But as you say, like, it's going back again, you know what I mean?
It circles, like, and the longer maybe you're in research or you're in the trade or using the results of research, you see these trends coming back around. It's like in the tillage, a rotation is suddenly something that's now very important again as well. Like, you know, but it's important to maybe understand why we lose sight of these perspectives. You know, why we lose perspective. You know, And a lot of it is that the nitrogen side of it, like, you know, you get that lovely visual green color. You know, farmers love it. And you know, there was a lot of farmers in the past, Jack, and, you know, you'd hear these anecdotally that by the time they nearly had the turkey digested, they were going with for urea, like, do you know? And you hear all these little snippets, and sometimes we have to hold our hands up as well. Everyone in the industry, and, you know, if you were not growing 15 ton, you were at nothing, and there you were out with your nitrogen. We all had a role to play in this. Why did we lose touch with it? Is another more complicated story, but we probably developed an over-reliance on nitrogen to mask these side health problems as well, you know, and that's where the problem really started, that instead of, you know, spreading our P's and K's, spreading our lime, just keep pushing off pushing out nitrogen and trying to get the same result.
Correct. A bit like dry cow tubes in the milking side of things, like, you know what I mean? Blanket across the herd and kind of cover up any issues, and some cows don't need it at all, you know? So again, there's a question mark over that. There's a question mark over a lot of the inputs. I mean, John, we've been talking to Frank O'Mara, to Andrew Cromley about the new technologies that are coming to help this carbon emissions reduction, you know, the kind of OA. And Andrew was on the breeding side of things, and he's talking about cows that produce less methane, you know, and you know, issues like this, that, like, we're not really on that journey yet, but, like, we need to get on it sooner rather than later if we're to have any impact and if it's to be any good to us, and that information is used, like, in terms of development at the kind of, I suppose, the agribusiness, the fertilizer side of the house. Like, I'm sure there's an ongoing train of research. Like, is there pieces happening, we'll say, and kind of what's happening in that space at the moment?
Yeah, there's massive amount of research going on, Jack, and I suppose the key is to get all these validated, and that's a structured approach and procedure. But behind the scenes in every agribusiness, there'd be product development and different opportunities. Obviously, in respect to biogenic methane, the feed additives is a big one. But I think it's very important that how these technologies might apply on farm as well. So I suppose what we're hearing on... Yeah, on the trial farms, like, what we're hearing on the trial farms is that maybe there's only a 6 or 8 week period from a feed additive that it's effective for. And you could say that maybe that renders that product or that additive redundant. But what if potentially we're using these in rotation, maybe like a cereal farmer uses chemistry, that for 6 or 8 weeks that you had a certain additive that would give you a benefit, and then after that... And that's where we need to get to the same with maybe multi-species swards. We're doing it in a full farm approach where it's farmlets, all multi-species, and that has to be done that way, I know. Yeah. But in a commercial farm, it's only going to be maximum maybe 10 or 15% of the platform that can actually be put into multi-species in the 1 year. And so how does that hybrid system work? We know that there's maybe concerns around the amount of clover and swards, and will we be able to get to establish number one? And maybe it's a situation where we have 30 or 40% of the farm going forward with a high level of clover where we can reduce nitrogen. And is there research going on that kind of a hybrid system? Mm. So all these things are going to come down the line. On the product side, there's a huge amount, I know, from our own side around, you know, biostimulation on crops or, you know, increasing soil health, increasing soil bacteria, indigenous soil bacteria, that now that's important, Jack. And to access more nitrogen from the soil, because there's a huge pool there, massive pool of nitrogen there in the soil that maybe we're not accessing yet.
I mean, the other piece of that whole piece that's happening is slurry and what you can do with slurry to make it more bioavailable, to make it more, I suppose, to limit the you know, emissions, etc., and that kind of thing. Like, I mean, there is, again, a big play in that, and it's a big part of the system, but probably protected urea takes more of the limelight, like we'll say.
Definitely, Jack. And when you look at the emissions breakdown, like, we are a significant part of it in Ireland in agriculture, because we're the only emitters of ammonia, which is fine. That doesn't mean, like, we say that as if it's an excuse. We still need to improve. No one's debating that. No. But when you look at protected urea or land spreading of manures, you know, fertilizer is only about 10% of the emissions problem. And spreading of slurry is 30%. Actually, the housing environment and animal manure storage is 50%, 48% to be exact. Do you know, and we can't fix this problem as simply as maybe a farmer over in in mainland Europe, where they have the cows housed all the time. They can let them out for 3 months. The co-op will pay them their bonus or the processor, because we're a grass-based system. We're out all the time. So it's more of a challenge to us. But I suppose slurry acidification, we've actually one product there, a bedding disinfectant that has been shown in independent research from AFBI to reduce ammonia losses and stuff like that. It's getting that scaled up and in the international register is going to be important, so that we can show that we're reducing ammonia losses from the housing environment, which is the key challenge. It's getting that one right. Huge amount of money spent on dribble bars, and you can't even get them, Jack. Like, you know,
at the moment, waiting list. Like, I mean, John, in terms of engaging with farmers at the moment, like, are your guys out in the ground, we'll say, what are they hearing in terms of, I suppose, what's happening in the fields, etc., and that kind of thing at this time of year?
Today we're actually out with Dairy Gold out in the field with the ASMs and our own agronomy team, and we were looking at the soil microbial test. So Liam Stack down in Dairy Gold has done a lot of work, and we work closely with him on soil biology, and we have our grass vest app to access more of these pools. So we were going through it as a group out in the field, and huge amount of interest, a lot of discussion groups on it at the moment as well, Jack, and a huge amount of interest because of fertilizer price, of course, but also because of the challenges, because, Jack, fertilizer will be reduced on a lot of farms next year because of price, but from 2023 there will be a register in place as well. So, like, we have to force change to get farmers thinking the right way about nutrients, getting the soil health right, getting more from the soil. But I suppose they're the key ones at the moment, Jack. But there's a huge amount of interaction between agribusinesses and ourselves at the moment to try and look at the soil sustainability program for suppliers going forward, because it's going to be a tricky year, I feel, just the way things are shaping up.
No, I agree. Good to hear. John, last question, because I know you're under pressure. In terms of, I suppose, next year and supply, is there any kind of further indications or anything happening within the trade that might suggest that supply might improve, or the at least the availability mightn't be as big an issue for next spring?
Yeah, Jack, to be honest, it's a very fluid situation, like, and it's changing, like, and it's not changing from week to week, like. You know, like, the prices could have moved from while we were chatting here now, like.
Yeah.
So it is a very challenging situation, but, like, where everyone is doing their best, all the companies, like, not just Grass and Agro, everyone is doing their best to make sure that it will be as small an issue as possible in the supply front. And I suppose the approach that we're talking, not trying to deflect from the question, because it is very important, but the thing that we're trying to do is to make sure that farmers who have problems with their soil aren't paying those crazy prices, because, Jack, you know, this doesn't excuse the fact, but you know the prices that have been quoted for urea, whatever, fine.
Yeah.
There's farmers for the last 10 years that have been paying those prices because of poor pH, poor P's and K's, poor soil structure. But it's not until someone actually went around and asked them for the money for it that they maybe thought about it this way. But in the same way, they could be losing 30, if they're only getting 30% efficiency out of a product that costs whatever the price, 7, 8, whatever, 100 ton, then that's a serious risk to their business. So we're trying to be proactive, get the soil sampling done early this year and try and provide a bit of advice, get lime out there, ground conditions are good, and try and get that job done.
Yeah, the danger is, John, it could be €1,500 a ton for those guys.
That's a fact, like, John.
You know,
It was seven, but when it was 300 a ton, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, no. But that's completely the wrong attitude, because of the emissions and all the speakers that you've had today.
Yeah.
You know, because it was cheap, we didn't maybe have enough respect for these nutrients.
Correct.
But they are key contributors to the overall emissions profile of the farm.
Absolutely. John, 100%. Thanks for the chat. We'll talk again soon. Excellent food for thought from John as normal. Right, folks, that's it for another week. We've had a bumper show, a real special on climate. Thanks for watching, and indeed, thanks for listening. Thanks to all our own specialists, and indeed to all our special guests, Frank O'Mara, Andrew Crommie, Tim Cullinan, Pat McCormack, and John O'Loughlin. If you want more Farmers Journal podcasts and webinars, go to ifj.ie/podcasts or ifj.ie/webinars. Indeed, there's another very good webinar just up this week related to this topic, where editor Justin McCarthy talks to Jason Clay from the World Wildlife Fund. We'll be back again next week. Until then, stay safe and safe farming.
when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.